Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly review of news media performance from the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab. Joining me this week are Views regular Lee Wilkins and sitting in for Charles Davis, media historian Ernest Perry. Lee and Ernest are faculty colleagues here at the Missouri School of Journalism. For obvious reasons, this week we're focusing on the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. CNN's John King says he's embarrassed by his false report that a suspect was in custody last Wednesday afternoon. The New York Daily News doctors a gruesome photo to make it a little less gory. The New York Post blames law enforcement for its decision to place a photo of two innocent bystanders on its front page under the headline "Bag Men." The social media site Reddit is condemned by some and praised by others over its hunt for the bombers, and we'll examine the stories journalists have pursued and should pursue in the wake of the Boston terror attack. Now, we should say up front that there was plenty of high-quality reporting on the events from Boston. The Boston Globe and the city's ABC affiliate, for example, have been singled out for great work. Many have singled out NBC's justice correspondent, Pete Williams, and there are other examples we could cite. But we're also going to look at several high-profile mistakes, ethical lapses, and controversies. One of the earliest occurred last Wednesday afternoon, just before Amy Simons, Lee, and Charles were taping our previous program. CNN's John King, a former Bostonian and one of the network's top journalists, reported that a suspect had been arrested. Well, that story was wrong. Soon thereafter, in a move much ridiculed by The Daily Show's Jon Stewart, CNN had to walk it back.
At this point, it appears that people who have been reliable sources to us in the past 48 hours either were giving us inaccurate information or got out ahead of themselves on something.
The information has been dribbling and drabbling. There's obviously been a lot of confusion.
You know, we don't know what's right or not right at this point. And as Anderson always says, you don't want to go down the road of speculation wrongfully.
But that's what you were doing! You spent an hour debating. You spent an hour debating the merits of your own fiction. See, we're accustomed to 24-hour news networks thriving on conflict. Generally, though, that conflict is between two outside parties, political opponents, pundits. But CNN's reporters have discovered that they can remove the middleman.
Now, Lee, I'm not trying to justify the mistake they made, and Stewart certainly had the right to make fun of CNN correcting itself, but really, isn't that what they should have done? Going on camera for several hours afterwards saying, we were wrong, we made a mistake.
You know, if they had done that, it would have been done and over. No, ultimately, yes, they did. But I think in the meantime, they tried to do a lot of blame shifting. I think they debated the merits of this, that, and the other thing, actually, which weren't at all conclusive. And they forgot that in journalism, the story's not us, and the story is not supposed to be us. And so all this chit-chat back and forth about what we did and the sources we talked to and whether or not they were leading us down the garden path just took everything out of the loop and put CNN and its mistakes front and center. And that, to me, was just inexcusable.
Yeah, I wonder, Ernest, I mean, obviously CNN wasn't the only news organization that made that mistake about the arrest. Fox News did it. The Boston Globe that we've praised did it as well. So did the Associated Press. So why all the focus on John King and CNN?
I think all the focus on CNN is because usually when something bad happens, something really tragic, the majority goes to CNN. They have created this reputation. They've developed this reputation of being the first on the scene, having boots on the ground. And this is one of those instances where everyone was looking at them for information. they provided it, but they provided the wrong information.
Well, so what do you do? I mean, again, I'm not trying to excuse the mistake, but when you have a senior correspondent using multiple sources in law enforcement that have been reliable, they say, in the past, and they tell you something that turns out to be wrong. I mean, what do you do with that, Lee?
Well, I think the first thing you do is you apologize for it and you admit the error and you move on. The ethicist in me wants to say that if you think people are deliberately misleading you, you're no longer obligated to keep their identities secret. I don't think that was the case here. I think there was a lot of there was enough confusion to go around. But I would also look at some of the new media outlets, Mike, that you decided is doing exemplary work. For some strange reason, I got stuck on NBC pretty early on in the event and essentially never left because every time I got ready to leave, they did something else right. So they used the word allege. They said, this is what we do know and this is what we don't know. Something that journalists way too seldom do. They said that they were getting conflicting reports. They talked about what they couldn't confirm. This was a much, much, much better job. And all of those things, those best practices were available to CNN and they weren't used.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that, I got stuck on NBC as well, but I think they created a template that I think can be used by other networks. And one of them was Brian Williams over and over again at certain points throughout their coverage would stop and say, here's what we know now, and would do an overview for people who were just maybe tuning in or coming back to see what was going on. And it gave them an opportunity to pause and stop and reevaluate what it was they knew, what they could confirm, what they couldn't, and then move on to any new information they might have. And that's something that I think CNN may want to try in the future.
Well, this may sound a bit naive, I suppose, but do we need to reevaluate the relationship between news organizations and individual journalists and law enforcement? I mean, look, just last night we learned that this Mississippi man that had not only been accused and arrested by law enforcement, but charged with sending those ricin-laced letters to the president and others, they had to exonerate him, and they're now looking at somebody else. So if we can't trust these law enforcement officials to get it right in cases that are this high profile, do we have to treat them in a different way?
I don't think we have to treat them any differently than we've always treated them, which is to say they are the first part of a system. Okay, just because you're accused, just because you're charged doesn't mean you're guilty. We've talked on the show umpty-ump times about everything from death penalty cases where the state has actually taken someone's life only to discover that they didn't commit the crime for which they received the death penalty, to much more minor infractions. The point is that law enforcement is a source. It is seldom the definitive source. There may not, in most criminal prosecutions, be a single definitive source. You gotta let it work its way through the system.
There were at least some folks who were suggesting after last week's coverage that real-time, event-oriented, or crisis journalism is just broken, at least on TV. Several print reporters, for example, including Farhad Manju at Slate, were saying that we should just turn off our TVs, turn off our laptops, turn off our smartphones, go to bed early, wake up the next day, pull out the latest story from the newspaper, and we'll get a much more accurate accounting of what's going on.
Well, I'm not so sure that we can go back to that because I think the public has gotten used to it and in a lot of ways expect to have this kind of coverage when you have an incident like what happened in Boston. But I think that there are best practices out there that can be followed. And I agree with Lee. One of the things that I think journalists need to do is you may have sources within law enforcement and it's good to use those sources, but you also need to understand that they may have an agenda as well. And you need to understand that you can be used by law enforcement in ways that you don't necessarily want to be used. I mean, when I say journalists. And I think this may be one of those instances where that may have happened.
Well, let's talk about one of those because King did apologize and said he was embarrassed. But I wonder if he was embarrassed for the right thing. For example, we know that he reported somebody had been arrested when that hadn't happened. But he also said this: I want to be very careful about this because people get very sensitive when you say these things. I was told by one of these sources who is a law enforcement official that this was a dark-skinned male, and that's the only description that was given.
I think this is an ethical breach. Law enforcement, at least all the police officers that I've dealt with, and I have seen descriptions like that, but it usually it comes with a height, usually it comes with a weight, and they'll be the first ones to tell you, at least, again, the law enforcement people that I've dealt with, that, you know, this is so vague as to be useless. We wouldn't be giving this to cops on the street. I mean, how much does that help you? So I just think mouth moving, brain not engaged.
I would agree. One of the things that we teach over and over again here at the Journalism School is when a description is given, it needs to be a much more defined description. And I think the problem with just stating that and coming back out and saying, well, this is what law enforcement is telling us, that it was a dark-skinned male. Well, you have to question that. You have to question that source a little bit more and say, okay, give me more. I mean, give me a height, give me a weight, give me hair color, give me something other than that. Journalists are not obligated to present information that's given to them by law enforcement. And if that information does more harm than good in terms of fostering stereotypes and maybe having people looking out for things that not necessarily the case, then I think we do a disservice to our viewers and to our audience.
Well, despite these lapses, and Lee, this is a point I bring up after almost every one of these big stories, CNN's ratings, both on air and online, went through the roof, and they did for Fox News as well. So is there really any downside in the long run to not being as careful as maybe we should be?
Well, I sure hope there is. I mean, one of the things that I did, and I don't know how many people were like that, is I kept trying to go back to CNN because it's kind of my go-to network, if you will, in certain situations, and this is one of them. And I would be on it for no more than 5 minutes and go, nope, too much hyperbole for me. Nope, I'm not getting credible stuff. And then flip back over, in my case, to NBC on the TV and sort of a rolling effort through the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, the Boston Globe, everything I could sort of reach on my laptop. So, I mean, I don't know whether it has any long-term impact, but it certainly has long-term impact professionally for those of us who are trying to figure out what's a better way to make it happen.
Well, let's turn our attention to a couple of instances where news organizations misled us with still images from the Boston bombing. The first involves the New York Daily News. The day after the Marathon bombing, the paper ran a photo taken by the Boston Globe showing two women injured in the attack, one sitting, the other one laying down on the sidewalk, covered and surrounded by blood. Well, if those of you who are watching the video, here's the two side-by-side close-ups. And if you look at it, you probably wouldn't notice it that the Daily News had photoshopped the original image to cover up a horrible leg injury that was suffered by one of the victims. But journalists at the Daily News and elsewhere certainly did notice it, and they cried foul. They said, Lee, that it violated the National Press Photographers Association's Code of Ethics, which says in part, do not manipulate images in any way that can mislead viewers or misrepresent subjects. And as one of the editors on a blog at the Orange County Register put it, if you can't stomach the gore, don't run the photo, period. Agree with that?
I absolutely agree with it. It is a violation, not just of the Press Photographers Association, but of the Radio and Television Journalists Association. I mean, there is no journalistic organization in this country of which I am aware that in their codes of conduct or in their ethics policies would condone this sort of alteration, particularly because it's absolutely going to be discovered. I mean, that's the thing about it. It takes no time at all to figure out what's been photoshopped and what hasn't.
So why did they do it, Ernest? Here's what the paper's spokesman had to say. The Daily News edited that photo out of sensitivity to the victims, the families, and the survivors. There were far more gory pictures that the paper chose not to run, and frankly, I think the rest of the media should have been as sensitive as the Daily News. What do you think about that? Cop out? Good rationale?
I think it was a cop out. I agree with Lee that they should not have altered the photo. And there is I don't know of any policy in journalism, in American journalism, and even foreign journalism that would condone altering a photo like that. And if they're saying that there were other gory photos, there were just as many good photos that they could have used. There were hundreds, right, if not thousands, of photos that they could have used that would have best illustrated the tragedy that had occurred. To doctor this photo just makes no sense.
Well, if the Daily News was guilty of omission, surely the New York Post was guilty of commission when it decided to smear two innocent young men last Thursday on their front page. And now we're going to show you again the images on our blog, or you can see it if you're watching the video. And here it is. One of the young men has a backpack. The other has a messenger bag. The headline reads, "Bag Men, Feds Seek These Two Pictured at Boston Marathon." Then only in much smaller type down at the bottom, you see this sentence. "There is no evidence linking them to the crime, but authorities want to identify them." I think I know the answer to this question, Lee, but does that caveat absolve the Post ethically?
Not in the least. This is what we call eyewash. It's using a photo as an illustration, which all it demonstrates is journalistic laziness. And as Ernest said, there were at this point thousands of photos available, not just from news organizations, but from citizen journalists, from just plain citizens, from people with their cell phone. They did not have to do this. They were lazy and they were trying to create controversy. Wait, it's the New York Post. What else have we come to expect?
And I'm pretty sure that there were hundreds of people out there with bags, all sorts of bags. And I think, you know, now that we know a little bit about what has happened, one of the things that tipped police off to the suspects that they were looking for was, as one of the bombs was going off, everyone was looking toward the explosion except the one person in the photo who was looking the other way, looking for the next explosion. And that's what gave them the information that they needed to ultimately find the two suspects that they ultimately went after.
Well, as we said, at least John King did apologize after the fact and express some embarrassment, but the New York Post's editor-in-chief didn't apologize at all. In fact, he said, "We stand by our story. The image was emailed to law enforcement agencies yesterday afternoon seeking information about these men, as our story reported. We did not identify them as suspects."
Yeah, they did. Anybody with the brains God gave a soda cracker would have jumped to that conclusion. Probably these two folks aren't going to sue. But if they were, I don't see, you know, reasonable people. No.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, maybe it is obvious, and we're not lawyers, but if these young men were to sue, especially the one whose face is recognizable, they have a chance of winning in a court with the damages against the paper?
I think in a court of law, you know, it's possible. Anything is possible when you have something of this nature that happens. But I think ultimately we need to understand that this is the New York Post, and this is what they do. They've done this before, so we shouldn't be surprised.
Well, we did get an apology from someone who helped fuel a lot of false speculation after the FBI's release of those photos last week. It was Eric Martin. He's the general manager of Reddit, the very popular social news website. Several Redditors, mostly volunteers, tried to track down the identities of the suspects after those photos were released. And at one point, they falsely identified suspect number two, that we now know of as the younger Tsarnaev brother, as an innocent Brown University student who's gone missing. So I wonder, did Reddit and other social media, as one LA Times headline put it, Lee, spiral out of control?
Yeah, although I wouldn't call it that. What I would say is there's a lot of role confusion going on here. At least that's what we say when we do it in ethics class. Our job is to report the news. Our job is not and cannot be to be law enforcement. Social media, because it walks in sort of this netherworld, if you will, I think hasn't really quite figured that out. And the result is that you have a lot of people with agendas, okay, most of them very laudable. I'm not saying bad things about that, who come in and say, well, I'm going to use my social media chops to see if I can essentially do what is law enforcement's job. And the problem is we don't do it very well. Reddit is a great example. And we certainly don't have the tools to bring to bear that law enforcement did. And I say that because we know there was a very loud, dangerous shootout in a suburb of Boston that night when law enforcement finally did catch up with the brothers. And for a journalist to have been involved in that, all that would have done was to have created more carnage.
I will say, my oldest daughter, who lives in Boston, my wife, were using Reddit as one of their primary tools for keeping tabs on what was going on. I mean, they were aggregating news from mainstream sources and others. They were supplying lots of information to the local community. And some people even said, Ernest, that they should be praised because, despite maybe some of these excesses by some of the sub-Redditors, as they're called, they were actually helping to hold a community together, at a time when there was a crisis going on.
And I think that that was important. I mean, I read a lot of stories and actually talked to people in Boston. I spent a summer there. Matter of fact, a mile away from where the shootout was where I was living when I was doing some work there. And I think it's important what they were doing, and I think it was helpful for that community, especially during the lockdown phase. But I also think that it should be important, incumbent upon those who are running those social media operations to understand that there are limits to what they can do and not cross over that line to where their helpfulness becomes a hindrance to law enforcement. And I agree with Lee that the media, be it social media, be it the mainstream media, should understand that their role is to inform and not to enforce the law.
Well, let's focus our remaining time on things that happened in the aftermath of the manhunt, the capture of the younger suspect, how and why the Tsarnaev brothers did what they did, and whether the media have learned anything that might improve how we handle the next crisis like this. And let's start out with the lockdown that you mentioned. I mean, it was unprecedented. Here we have an entire city of more than a million people basically all staying in their homes, those who complied anyway. We also had, on top of that, the media sort of breathless 24/7 coverage. Some people suggest that might have even given terrorists what they want and might encourage future attacks. What do you think of that?
There's one of my favorite definitions of terrorism is few people dying and a lot of people watching. All of our recent terrorist activities haven't conformed to that definition, but I think this one really does. It's hard for me to know whether or not in the process of giving terrorists some oxygen, which I think we clearly did, if to do anything other than what we did would not have, as Ernest so ably said, tried to help keep that community together. I mean, I certainly think there were a lot of missteps, but it's also clear that people who were in Boston, who were essentially housebound under what I would call martial law, needed to have as much information as they could, and their only decent source of information at that point was mediated information, regardless of where you get it.
I would agree, and I also think that I'm not quite sure that you could say that the media did or did not learn something from this, because I think that one of the things that the media learned was, number one, that it can be an informing source of information for people who are in these situations where, I agree with Lee, there is somewhat of a martial law there. And I also think that it helps them to understand the importance of cooperating with law enforcement and with the first responders in dealing with this. The only way they were able to do this, to have that many people in a lockdown situation, was for them to comply. And I think that law enforcement was able to demonstrate the importance of them not being on the streets and letting them do their jobs.
I mean, I agree with all that, but there are writers who suggest that, you know, really the city of Boston, no individual person was in any more jeopardy during this manhunt for the younger brother than in any other city due to all kinds of other sorts of crimes that go on there all the time. And yet all of the pictures we broadcast all around the world showing this city in lockdown, doesn't that, Lee, just suggest that we pay so much attention to these kinds of incidents, maybe even out of proportion to the harm that's done, that we're just going to see more and more of it?
I don't know if we're going to see more and more of it, but I think this is a place where there are lessons to be learned, and I think it's going to take some nuanced thinking about it, because this was a big news story. I think that we need to have a debate as a democratic society of whether putting the entire city of Boston under lockdown was effective, particularly because I think the police knew a little bit more than they were telling us. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there's a lot of things to discuss here, but it's to discuss as a society, and of which the media are a part, but we're not the only part that's involved.
Yeah, we're definitely in uncharted territory here, both from a media perspective in terms of journalists and social media presenting information, but I also think we're in uncharted territory as a society, especially from a governmental policy as well as a law enforcement. which way do we go? How do we deal with the situation the next time it happens? It may be putting just a neighborhood in lockdown as opposed to an entire city. Right now, I think there's a lot of assessment going on all sides to try to determine what's the best way to handle the next situation like this that occurs.
Well, most journalists now see their job appropriately as very aggressively pursuing some questions that need to be answered. What were the means and what were the motives of the attackers? But we're also, it seems to me, seeing a lot of sort of rather predictable framing, especially by some of the left and right-leaning media. Fox News, for example, just seems fixated right now on radical Islam. It's almost in every story. Then there are stories like those in the Boston Globe this weekend that suggest, well, religion only played a secondary role in the bombing. So how do we balance being sensitive with providing the facts that the public really needs to know, the questions they need to have answers to?
Well, not that Fox especially is going to pay any attention to me, but we need to realize this is one story among many. We need to report it and then move on. We don't need to become fixated on it. Certainly, there are all kinds of radicalism, probably including radical hot dog eating. So the notion that somehow we're going to put that adjective out there in front of something, especially some religion, and then somehow that makes it newsworthy. That's not only is that not best practices, it's just plain dumb.
Yeah, I think it feeds into the common narrative, or into the stereotype that sort of fits into what we want people to believe. And we as journalists should not fall into that because, as Lee said, I mean, you can radicalize almost anything. And I think when we start talking about radical religion, we could say radical Islam, radical Judaism, radical Christianity. I mean, we can just go all down the line and we can find instances in which some action taken by that particular religion can fit into what we would define as radicalism. And I think that's a dangerous road for journalists to go down because we shouldn't be in the business of defining people and defining religions based on what we think. It should be based on their voices and their concerns and how they live their lives. And I think that's one of the things that we don't do very well. And maybe we should we should be doing a better job of that.
Well, we talked about the stories that have been reported so far. Let's think a little bit ahead. And Lee, this is one of those popular questions we like to ask on this show. What story should we be focusing on in the days and weeks ahead? What do you want to know most that journalists can help us to know?
I want to know most about the amount of altruistic behavior that happened right after the bombing took place, but also that continues to happen. We tend to report these as, you know, one-offs. There's a fund that you can contribute to, or there were doctors and nurses who ran forward. But I think there's a much bigger story there about the level of altruism and community that was demonstrated as a result of this, and that I think actually helped folks get through. So that's a place where, forget the radical part. Let's focus on the radical altruism that happened here and use that as a way to explore some of what people were thinking and feeling and responding to at the height of all of this chaos.
Ernest?
Well, I think one of the stories that should be talked about is the available amount of explosive material that's out there. Things that people can use and that people have in their homes on an everyday basis that can be turned into an IED. And that's something that I think there are stories of that are coming out, but I don't think we really know. I mean, we're talking about a regular homemade pressure cooker.
In fact, I saw one report this morning that suggested that they might have bought the actual black powder at a fireworks retailer in New Hampshire. Right. So you can get this stuff just about anywhere.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think we were joking before, but maybe it's not so funny as I don't use a pressure cooker because I'm afraid it will explode. I suppose you could really literally flip that and say, as Ernest said, what are the common things that we all have in our homes that could be put to mischievous use?
Right. I think we also need to know, of course, and I hope we will find out, what the real connection was between Russian intelligence authorities and our own. How much did they tell us? How much did they not tell us? Because that would be really important. Well, there's much more to say about this topic, but that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Lee and Ernest for their insights, and thanks you for listening and watching. You can find audio, video, and other stories related to our topics on our Links blog. It's under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. We welcome your questions or comments via email. The address there is views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show. KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Mike McKean. Amy Simons will be your host again next week. Join her, Lee, and Charles for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.